So I have the pleasure to introduce two very excellent activists who have been brought together in two very different ways, but are drawing the same conclusions about the occupation of Iraq. So we've got Karee Peterson-Smith, who is a senior at Rochester Institute of Technology, who was able to travel to Iraq in January with a delegation for United for Peace and Justice. And he's going to be speaking for approximately 15, as long as he needs. We're going to have some time for discussion afterwards, but to really, I think, put a human face on the occupation that we've been discussing this whole weekend. And I also have Mike Hoffman, who was involved in the invasion of Iraq with the Marines back in May. So, and who is now a veteran and an activist at a school outside of Philadelphia. So two people brought together to end the occupation of Iraq, and we're very glad to have them. Karee's going to speak first. Yeah. So why don't we welcome Karee.
I want to. I don't want to be too long because I'd like to have go ahead with this discussion. But I think that it's appropriate to begin with the events that took place earlier this week. We know that on April 1st, many of us who saw the front pages of newspapers saw pictures of these. Saw pictures of Iraqis celebrating the killing of these security personnel in the town of Fallujah, the city of Fallujah in Iraq. The New York Post here, New York's own, that the headline was "The Barbarians of Fallujah." That's what they called the Iraqis. And the New York Times actually wasn't much better. It's the my speech. But you know, people probably have seen the picture. You can see it's this mob. Jubilant in their celebration of what's going on. Sorry, my stuff's all over the place. But the point is, you have the conservative press and the liberal press unite to demonize these people and call them portray Arabs as a bloodthirsty mob. Arabs as savages. It's my understanding that in one of the two main newspapers in Boston, the headline was "Savages" in describing the Arabs. And those of you who've heard me speak know that I like to open by talking about by quoting usually the New York Times, because I think that they're really leading the way in terms of justifying the American Empire in the way that passed, in the way that Rudyard Kipling justified the British Empire, the idea of this white man's burden and whatnot. And I think that the New York Times is doing a great job of kind of laying the ideological justification for the American Empire. So we can counterpose their coverage of the events in Fallujah with the newspaper on Sunday, March 21st, 2004, which it's the day after the anniversary of the war. And, of course, it's the Sunday New York Times, so it's the issue that people are going to read this week. So to commemorate a year of war and occupation in Iraq, who should they feature on the cover, and who should they do a feature article on? In the New York Times, should it be, I don't know, the Iraqi people whose country was invaded, who are now occupied? Could it be something about the thousands and thousands of Iraqis who've been killed in that invasion and occupation? Or even perhaps U.S. troops who are actually, on the ground there and carrying out the occupation and whatnot? No, the New York Times decided to do a feature article on L. Paul Bremer III, the U.S. Viceroy of Iraq, essentially. I wish I could, project his photo on the big screen, but he has a look like this, very, very serious. And he's just when we talk about the whole idea of empire and the caricatures that this country draws up and these media draw up of the people who are occupied. Let's listen to Mr. Bremer right here. He's speaking about an attack that occurred the day before this press conference he's speaking at. "Tuesday showed us the dark vision of the evildoers," he said, his voice shaking with anger. They fight to ward off harmony and are happy to pave the road to power with the corpses of their innocent victims. So evildoers, I mean, I think we know about this absurdity of a line in the sand between good and evil, and of course the United States is on the side of good and whatnot, and I won't go into it, but the Times goes on to describe the way that Paul Bremer dresses and how he, you know, wears his combat boots with a silk tie, and it's like, who cares about these things, you know, frankly? But that's who they're choosing to celebrate. That's who they're portraying as the hero in Iraq, bringing civilization to these backwards people. The thing that's absent, of course, from the portrayal of Iraqi people in the coverage of the New York Times and really of all the corporate media, the way they're covering this occupation, what was amazing about one of the amazing things about the photos that we saw on April 1st is that you don't really see many Iraqis on the cover of the New York Times. In fact, you never see the Iraqis who are killed in humiliating and degrading ways. And when I was in Iraq, I heard some horrific stories. There was a doctor we hung out with, Dr. Ala Youssef, who's a doctor at this hospital, surgeon. And somehow he found himself involved in a firefight. He was on the street, and he was a bystander watching a gun battle between U.S. troops and guerrillas. And the troops killed the guerrilla fighters. And the commander of the troops who was there said, okay, he went up to one of the bodies of these guerrillas and he said, we're going to take this guy and put him up on that pole to show what happens when you take up arms against us. And so Dr. Ala found himself talking to this guy, trying to convince him, look, if you do this, this is going to inspire rage in people. You know, you can't, this is just going to make things worse. Don't do that. And he was eventually able to convince him not to do that. But those are the kinds of horrific, you know, ways in which Iraqi people are being killed. We also heard several stories of troops killing Iraqis and then afterward going up on them and putting their boots on their dead bodies, which is obviously a horrible thing in any culture, but in the Arab world particularly, to show anyone the bottom of your feet, let alone to put your boot on the dead body of a loved one, is so absolutely degrading. And so, you know, while you have this mob kind of, so you see the portrayal of the Iraqis in this way, but you never see the ways in which, the horrific ways and degrading ways and humiliating ways in which Iraqis are being killed. And I think that we should understand what kind of effect this has on the consciousness of people in the United States. It's like these bursts of rage just kind of come out of nowhere, you know, because there's no kind of other side to explain why are Iraqis so angry. Or that, as Bush suggests, they do come from somewhere. They come from the fact that this is about the enemies of civilization against the rest of us. You know, that these are these backwards people who are just a bunch of religious fanatics who are, you know, essentially they're not civilized people, and that's why the U.S. needs to be there. And what that does, obviously, is legitimizes the war. The whole idea is, look, these people obviously can't, you know, they're celebrating these deaths. They obviously can't run a country. There's something fundamentally wrong with them. That's why the U.S. needs to be there. And I think, too, it's meant to drive a wedge into the anti-war movement, frankly. It's meant to discourage us from doing what we're doing, which is calling out the U.S. occupying forces for the war crimes that they're committing. And actually, the day after April 1st, I guess April 2nd, on one of the discussion lists, the article list, someone named Bob, he's in Madison, Wisconsin, actually, he posted to the list, And he said this: can't we be honest about this? It's the Sunnis, not the Iraqis, that are the problem. Kind of like the Tories in the American Revolution. And he goes on to talk about how the Sunni Arabs, you know, they're the real problem here. And you know, it's like, if we just control them, then that'll be okay. And so you have this racist portrayal of Iraqis. You have the demonization of the so-called Sunni triangle, and it's meant to drive a wedge, you know, right through our society, but right into our movement as well. The truth is that the Iraqis who I met when I was there, the Shias, the Kurds, and the Sunnis, you know, they're not monsters, they're not savages or barbarians or bad guys or evildoers. They're human beings who've been put into inhuman situations, into inhuman conditions. And we have to talk about the horrific toll of the sanctions to begin with. Economic sanctions, it was a program of an economic embargo that was imposed on Iraq in 1991. During that invasion, through the United Nations. And they kept certain goods out of Iraq, civilian goods, things like food, medicine, batteries, ambulances, you know, you name it, all kinds of things were kept out of the country. And as a result, it killed 1.5 million people. There was the Oil for Food program, which we heard about today. Someone brought that up today. And this was a program through the United Nations where the country of Iraq could exchange oil for food, which I think in itself is pretty disgusting. You give us your oil, we'll give you food. But the caloric intake that allowed for, you know, the amount of calories that allowed Iraqis to have was actually lower than the caloric intake of the dogs who worked for the UN mission in Iraq. You know, that's the kind of suffering that Iraqi people had lived with for 13 years. And then, of course, there was the invasion. We remember shock and awe. You know, this is what people were subjected to. And then the occupation, of course, in which people are being killed daily in ways that we don't hear about at all. People are being rounded up daily in ways that we don't hear about at all. And really, people are just losing control of their lives and of their country every day in ways that we don't hear about here. But what I think, for me, what's the glimmer of hope in all of this is that Iraqis haven't taken this sitting down. You know, they've actually stood up. They haven't just submitted. They've resisted. And this is incredibly inspiring. And we've talked quite a bit about resistance today. You know, I think that, first of all, resistance starts with your heart. There's a story that I tell, and I've some of you have heard it if you've heard me speak, but I want to tell it again because, for me, it's so inspiring. On my last night in Baghdad, I spoke to a woman, a young woman named Kitaf. She's in high school in Iraq. She was 16 at the time. Now she's 17. And she was telling me about how her whole life has been war. She was born in 1987, the last year of the Iran-Iraq War. She remembers the 1991 invasion when she was a little kid. She lived through the economic sanctions, and then she lived through the latest invasion. And she told me what it felt like to see American tanks rolling down her street in Baghdad. What it's like to see barbed wire all over the place in Baghdad now, and what it's like to see her country fall apart, and to see these foreigners occupying her country. A few weeks before I had gotten there, she'd seen a dead body for the first time, and that was obviously a traumatic experience and something that she was dealing with. And so on this night, she was talking to me, and she was particularly depressed about her future. You know, I think that we all have dreams about our futures, no matter who we are, but I think for young people especially, you know, you have these dreams of what you want to be when you grow up and things like that. And Kitaf was saying, you know, how can I have a future? You know, she was understanding that her future is being curtailed by this occupation. And she was looking for me to say something inspiring, which is tough. And I told her, you know, I can see why you feel like this, why you feel, you know, so hopeless, but you can't let them take away your dreams, because if they've done that, then they've won. You know, they've taken your country, but you can't let them take away your dreams. And she said, yeah, but what can I even dream, you know? And I told her, well, you know, you didn't choose to live in this situation. Most of us don't get to choose the circumstances that we live in, but the choices we make in those situations, in those circumstances, those are ours, and no one can take those away from us. And she said, well, what can I choose? And I said, anything you want. And she said, I choose resistance. You know, and I just think, you know, it says a lot about the courage of this young woman, and it says a lot about the human spirit. And she's not sure what that means yet, but the resistance begins first with her heart, you know, saying that I'm not going to submit to this. You know, you're not going to win, essentially. But then we know that it spreads on to other areas. You know, there are all kinds of forms of resistance, whether it's political protests, whether it's, you know, organizing in the labor movement and striking, and whether it's taking up arms. I just want to say, and again, this is a discussion that I'm really glad that we're having about the whole nature of resistance and what does that mean, and what does it mean for us here in the Campus Anti-War Network. And specifically, what resistance means to me, you know, when I was reading the articles about Fallujah, one of the things that the reporters noted is that this event was kind of a break from the past few weeks, which has been relatively calm. And that's because the U.S. Army has stayed out of Fallujah. You know, they haven't set up bases whereas in other cities, in Baghdad certainly, they set up bases in the cities. But in Fallujah, they actually set up bases outside of the city. And they've been reluctant to go into the city to patrol. Well, why? Because Fallujah is a hotbed of the resistance. You know, and that's what peace means to me. The army stays out. They're not killing soldiers. And Iraqis aren't being killed either. There's a neighborhood in Baghdad, Amiriyah, which is really the hotbed in Baghdad of resistance. And we met a family who lost their son in Amiriyah. Amaria, I believe that's actually pronounced. And she was telling us about how her son was in his 20s, and he was just caught in the crossfire. You know, he didn't ask to be killed, but he was shot dead. And they don't want this to happen to any other family. You know, they never want anyone to go through what they're going through. And so, you know, going back to how we feel about U.S. troops, of course I sympathize with U.S. troops. They're working class kids, you know, disproportionately Black and Latino from our urban centers where really you don't have much of a future, you know, if you're growing up in this generation, or from the rural, you know, from rural poverty. That's why people join the military, because there isn't much of an alternative. And they have no interest in being there either. And so, of course, I sympathize with them. And I also sympathize with, you know, the mother whose eyes I looked into, who is talking about her son and how he's never going to come back. What it means that Amaria is a hotbed of resistance is that U.S. patrols, they don't do patrols in Amaria anymore. Because, you know, because that's where the resistance is strong, and that's peace. You know, that means that fewer families are going to have to deal with this in that neighborhood. That means that fewer troops are going to be killed in that neighborhood. And so that's what resistance means to me, and that's what it means in terms of bringing peace to Iraq. You know, I think that it's going to come from the ground. That said, I want to move on because we have another speaker, and we have this discussion to have. I just want to talk about the importance of CAN and what we've done, and really underscore something that we haven't made a point of enough is just the accomplishment that it is that we're here again. You know, that we were established last year. You know, we went through the invasion. We regrouped after the invasion, and we're still here a year later. You know, we're not going anywhere. And it meant so much to people when I went there. You know, it was great. Iraqis, most of the Iraqis I met didn't speak a whole lot of English, but I could kind of communicate basically why I was there. I would say, you know, I'm from America. I'd say, where are you from? I don't look Iraqi. I don't know if you look a little hair, threw people off. They'd say, where are you from? And I'd say, America. And they'd say, why are you here? And I'd say, you know, in America, they tell us America is bringing freedom to Iraq. I came to see the truth. And they say, that's great. You know, and then they'd tell me about what the reality is. And it was so important to me and so important to the Iraqis I spoke with to say that there are people in America who are against this and who are organizing against this. And whenever we ask people, what can we do? You know, when we sat with these families who lost their loved ones, you know, to bullets or to detention centers, and we asked, what can we do? They said, tell everyone. Go home and tell everyone you know about what the truth is here, you know, what's really going on here. So I just wanted to say that what we're doing here is so important. You know, we should never forget that, and that we're part of a living, breathing struggle. You know, and well, that's all I have to say for now. Thank you.
Okay, can everybody hear me without the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay. I hate podiums. All right, well, one thing Kareem talked about is things that have happened, unfortunate things that have happened because of the U.S. troops being there.
I'm sorry. If the only thing is that if you don't speak into that mic, we don't get it recorded.
Oh, you're recording this. Okay. All right.
You don't have to be close.
What's that?
Close.
Okay. Is it this microphone?
Yeah.
Or that one? Okay, well, anyway, as I was saying, you know, we've heard before about atrocities that are happening because of the atrocities that are being done by the U.S. troops there. Well, anything that happens, be it, you know, what happened in Fallujah to the U.S. mercenaries or what the U.S. troops are doing to the Iraq people, those things don't just happen to normal people. Normal people under normal circumstances don't do things like that. It's not in the normal human mind to do things. So something's driving these troops to do these things, you know, and what is it? It's frustration. It's the fact that they're stuck in a war they don't believe in, that they don't understand, and they're not being supported, and they're being forced to do things they don't want to do. No one in the military wants to kill anyone. Nobody wants to get shot at and killed. You might hear military people talk tough, say, yeah, I want to go do, you know, going to go kill somebody. They don't mean that. When you know, that's when they're all amongst a big bunch of people, and they're, you know, when they're either amongst a bunch of their friends from their unit, or they're out in a bar, and, you know, somebody's like, ooh, you're in the military. They say stuff like that. But when you actually sit down and talk to them one-on-one, like I did with my friends over there, nobody wanted to get into this. We were forced into this. You know, we didn't see ourselves as having any options. Even me, I was someone going into this, I knew what was going on. I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. I knew that, you know, this wasn't about getting rid of Saddam Hussein or instilling democracy in Iraq. It was about oil and money. That's what it was about in the U.S. And you know what? The troops knew that too. About a week before my unit left for Kuwait, our first sergeant addressed the entire unit. This is someone who's been in the Marine Corps for about 20 years. So this guy knows what's going on. And normally you would expect people like this to really, you know, hold the line and be like, yeah, you're going in there, you're doing a good thing, fight for mom and apple pie and all that. That's not what he told us. He got all 120 of us around him and said, listen, don't think you're heroes. Don't think you're going over there because there's weapons of mass destruction. Don't think you're going there to get rid of Saddam Hussein and make Iraq safe for democracy. You're going there for one reason and one reason alone, and that's oil. But he followed that up by really telling us the main thing behind – this is actually the main reason we haven't seen the big GR revolt like we'd seen in Vietnam. Because the reason the guys are still over there is because their friends are there. And you've got this cohesion that was built up that they didn't have in Vietnam, that the units that are there now, they're fighting alongside people they've known for 3 or 4 years, just like I did. And when you're over there, all the politics get pushed aside. All your personal feelings about hating George Bush and, you know, hating having to fight over oil get displaced. And the only thing that matters to you is making sure your friend who's next to you comes home alive. And I think one thing we need to make them understand is that there's options to this. There's other ways to make sure you get home alive and your friends get home alive. And we need to make – the reservists are the ones we really need to pound it into because they're the ones we see every day. Every school, I guarantee you, has – you know, you got at least, what, 5% of your whole – of all the students on a campus are probably reservists. Because when you talk to any single reservist, they join up and they go to college. They got their money for college, great. I'm ready to go. These are the guys you got to hit. These are the ones you see every day and you have access to. And these, what's good about them is that they know the military, but they're also civilians. So they process what they see in the civilian world, unlike the active duty guys. So these are the guys who see all these conflicting reports on the news. And reservists are a lot more open-minded than your active duty because they don't hear the propaganda day in, day out like the active duty does. So these are the ones you can hit and you can really make a difference with. And it can just start small with planting a few ideas in somebody's head. That's what it was with me. I just happened to pick up a book by Noam Chomsky at the right time in my life. And I read it. It wasn't a huge book. It was actually, I think it was Noam Chomsky for Beginners. Real basic book. It was probably like 120 pages with lots of pretty pictures. And reading that made a difference for me because it planted those ideas in my head. And what we got to do is we got to get to these guys and plant ideas. We've got to make them aware of what's really going on. We've got to let them know that all these contractors that are supposed to be providing support for them in Iraq, they're not. They're taking that money and running with it. And the soldiers on the ground are getting screwed because of it. You know, the fact that, you know, everyone in Iraq is supposed to have 2 ballistic plates for their flak jacket. What ballistic plates are? They're ceramic plates. One goes in the front of the flak jacket, one goes in the back. Probably the best piece of gear I've ever seen for protection because this will actually stop an AK-47 round dead. You get shot in the chest with an AK-47 and you have one of these plates in, you'll fall over. You'll probably have some bruise, cracked ribs or something like that. But you'll fall over, get back up, and start shooting back. They will save your life if you have them and they work properly. Because right now the situation in Iraq is that, you know, they claimed up and down that this is the most prepared they have ever been for any military operation. If that's the fact, I don't want to see what they were going through in the other military operations. Because just looking at the flak jackets alone, with the exception of the infantry, where everybody in the infantry had at least one ballistic plate, you were lucky if you had one ballistic plate per person. My unit, we had one per person. We got real lucky on that supply issue. But the issue is that, okay, you have one ballistic plate. You stick it in your front. Well, let's say you got shot in the back. Okay, so you get shot in the back. You don't have a ballistic plate. It passes through your torso, hits the ballistic plate in the front of your body, ricochets back through your body. So you're talking the entrance wound and the exit wound. It travels through your body twice. And if anyone knows anything about physics and ballistics, it does more damage passing back out. It's slowed down. It's lost momentum. It's probably mushroomed. It's ricocheting over every piece of bone that it can find in your body. So just imagine that. And that's what happens if you don't have two ballistic plates. And guess what? A lot of guys don't have two ballistic plates. The infantry commanders realized this, and a lot of units were being told, if you only have one ballistic plate, don't wear it, because of that exact issue. And guess what? Most units still don't have two ballistic plates per person. And now it's coming out that the company that was contracted to make these ballistic plates has been so pushed to catch up with the demand and the lack of ballistic plates, they're now putting out faulty ballistic plates. So even if you do get one of these great pieces of gear, it's if you get shot, guess what? It's liable to go right through the thing. And it's also things where missupply, where they might need, you know, they might need 50 small ballistic plates, where they get 25 small ballistic plates and 25 large ballistic plates. And guess what? The large ballistic plates are not going to fit in a small flak jacket. It takes a real rocket scientist to figure that one out. And that's what you're dealing with. You talk about frustration and you know, people being brain dead. The command over there, it's the same problem they had in Vietnam, they've had in every single war. You've got career officers who are glory hounds looking for promotions. And you're seeing reports of this coming out of Iraq. The staff sergeant who just turned himself in Florida, who was a reservist, he said flat out that his unit was ambushed while in convoy. The standard operating procedure across the board, every single unit you will ever see in the military, if you get ambushed while in convoy, you step on the gas, get out of there, regroup later, and, you know, do whatever. But you do not engage the enemy. You just get out of there. You are going to lose that fight if you're ambushed. He was reprimanded by his commanding officer because he did not stand and fight. Basically, because he did not stay there and needlessly risk the lives of the troops underneath him, he was reprimanded. So you ask, why are troops doing things like this? Frustration, rage, and it's rightful rage. I'm not saying the way they're expressing it is good, but the rage is justified because they're being used. They know they're being used. They know they don't want to be there. They're on the ground. They are searching these ammo dumps that Saddam had. They're in these ammo dumps. They don't see weapons of mass destruction. They know more than anyone else, just like I did when I went over there. There are no weapons of mass destruction. You know, the people in the military know more than you think. They know that, you know, the chemical weapons that Saddam used in 1980 were sold to him by the United States. They're aware of these facts. They're aware that the mass graves from back in the 80s were created while Saddam Hussein was basically under the protection of the United States. The military knows this. The regular public needs to give them more credit for what they know. And because of this, it's the frustration that's building up. And I said over and over again, I'm seeing that we're not doing this, but we need to support the troops in everything we do. We need to give them support. When I spoke in Fayetteville, we actually had about 5 active duty guys show up to the rally that day. And my main point in speaking, I hope they carry it back to their units, is speak out, resist, do anything you can. We will support you. That's one thing they need to be told over and over again, because they don't think anyone wants to hear them. But we need to let them be known. We need to let them know that we want to hear them. And the mass media is doing everything they can to make sure that message doesn't get out. I've been interviewed left and right by international media. I've print media. I mean, national news in Japan and Germany, Canada. I've already done a live broadcast with Canada's morning show. And, you know, that's a big thing. But yet major American media has completely ignored me. I did get interviewed by CNN. I gave a 20-minute interview. I thought it was a good interview. They asked me political questions, things like that. 20-minute interview got cut down to 15 seconds, and they deleted every single political comment I made. They did not mention the group I was part of, Veterans for Peace. They did not mention that they interviewed me while I was in Washington, D.C. for an anti-war rally. This is what they're fighting. They're trying to keep it down. They're trying to keep it away from the troops, the fact that we want to hear them. But we need to pass on that message. Anyone who has any family members, let them know that if they don't agree with this, they can speak out. There's groups to help them out. GI Rights Hotline is a great group. Center for Conscientious Objectors, which is run by the Quakers, another really good group. They will help them out. Whatever they decide to do, there is help for them. if they want to speak out, they can call Veterans for Peace, and we can help them out in any way they can. There's web resources. All these groups can be found on the web, and all of them have hotlines you can call to get help. So if you have family members, friends in the service, no matter where they are, call them, let them know. If Tom Barton's here from the Traveling Soldier. If you have family members, get the address, get the web address to the Traveling Soldier, forward that to them. Say, hey, check it out. Let them know that if you possess a copy of this, they can't do a damn thing to you. If you're allowed one piece of literature like that to yourself, if you have more than that, they can say you're distributing. But you're allowed to have one copy. But guess what? Nothing's stopping you from printing out a copy and handing it to your friend real quick or giving them the web address. So there's ways to get around this stuff, and we've got to start doing it. Thank you.
Okay, so we got 15 minutes for Monique. What? Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought there was an announcement. We have 15 minutes for a brief discussion.
Well, I think it's, what you're saying is exactly right, what's going on. I mean, from the second we hit the ground, they ceased being Arabs or Iraqis. They became Hajis, Talheads, or I hate using the term sand niggers. Those were the three terms they used there. I hate saying it, but it's the truth. And that really leads to what you're talking about, where they cease to become people. But I think, but another point you made is we show we support the troops. When we were at Fayetteville, there was a counter demonstration across the street of about 50 members of a group called Rolling Thunder, which is a Vietnam veterans motorcycle group. And at first, you know, they were jeering us, revving their engines. But as we spoke, they gave up their rally and actually started supporting us. When we sat there and somebody called out all the chicken hawks, Bush, you know, all the people supporting the war that didn't serve, and they have family members who got out of service somehow, they started cheering us on. When we kept saying, support the troops, bring them home now, they cheered us on. And about halfway through our rally, they all disappeared. So I think the stance we're taking is support the troops is a very hard one to fight. I think it's going to win over a lot of people. Now, when you're talking about the raids, the hardest thing we have to do is get to the people and make them realize that to place their rage where it needs to go, which is at their officers, at the generals, at Bush and Congress and people like that. It's hard to do, but as we start targeting the reservists. As reservists start rotating into Iraq, they're going to take those ideas with them. They're going to get put in with active duty units. They're going to interact with active duty units. They're going to take publications like Traveling Soldier with them. They have internet access. If you know somebody who's got email in Iraq right now, email them a copy of Traveling Soldier. Email them the web links. Email them articles you see that are really critical and really expose what's really going on. Let them know what's going on with the flak jackets. Let them know about the shortages, that money that they're supposed to be getting in supplies is getting skimmed off the top, so they know where to place a raid, so they can transfer that from the Iraqi people where it's misplaced to the leadership here in the U.S. where it should be properly placed.
Just so people know, Mike and Cree are going to come back at the end, so we've got about 13 minutes for discussion. So I've got Vassar, Northeastern, Hunter, and then Tom in the back.
All right. Couple things before I'm done for today. First of all, to address what you said, what they can do is they are entitled to congressional representation. They can write letters, and officially there can be no repercussions as long as they don't make false statements. So they can do that. The other thing is just like any other organizing movement. There's power in numbers. And there was actually in Vietnam this happened. It got so bad that there were so many units mutinying as the war went on that they stopped keeping count of how many units were doing this. Individual units were refusing to go on patrol and take orders. So it got to the point where the officers actually had to bargain with the enlisted men to get them to do something. Like if he wanted them to go move this stuff from point A to point B, he said, oh, we don't want to do that. And he would actually bargain with them, well, okay, well, if you do that, I'll give you 2 days libo. Make it three and we'll do it. Okay, 3 days libo, you can. They had to do that. Because they knew if they didn't do that, there'd be repercussions on them. Because there was fragging, which I'm not endorsing. I would never endorse an act of violence. But they would warn the officers. Like the officer would go to his rack at night, and he'd find a grenade pin laying in his rack. That'd be his first warning. If he didn't listen to this, they'd rig his tent. So when he walked into his tent, a CS grenade would go off. And if he didn't listen to that, well, things might get a little bit more serious. But they'd warn him. They'd let him know that, listen, we don't like you. We don't like what you're doing. And the higher-ups would do things like rotate commands. Well, they would see that the troops were getting sick of this captain, so they'd send him somewhere else and give him somebody else and let them get sick of him. And then when they got sick of him, they just kept processing it like that. And to what you said, I completely understand what you go through. I'm dealing with my own demons right now from what I went through. I mean, I understand what the repercussions of this war are in people terms. And a lot of guys who came back won't face it. One thing that really sticks in my mind is after our regional Vest for Peace meeting, there was discussion about sending a delegation to Iraq. And I put my name up. I said, listen, I would be interested in doing this possibly. I got to figure out if I really want to do this. And a little while later, I was talking to one of my friends who I served in Iraq with, who's now out and living in Indiana. And we were just talking a little bit. I mentioned to him that, you know, I might go back to Iraq on this trip. And he looked at me, he's like, well, why do you want to do that? And I told him the story of I was at a cafe in Philadelphia doing a talk, and there's another speaker there, Linda Panetta with School of America's Washington Northeast. And she had photographs of Iraqi children who were in hospital. I mean, their bodies were just shattered. That you could see that there were like metal rods running through their legs and things like that. And I had to get up and leave. I just lost it seeing these photos. And I told my friend about this, and his response was, that's the exact reason I couldn't go to Iraq. A lot of people are aware of what they've done and they don't like it, but the easiest way isn't to face it. And for me, I think the best thing to do is actually face it, because if I wasn't out here doing things like this, I think I'd be a basket case right now. Speaking like this is what really saved me. Even with doing this, I've got my bad nights. I mean, you can talk to anyone who knows me. There's days I show up in class and I'm literally shaking because I haven't slept all night. You know, and I'm better than most. And I didn't even see face-to-face what I did. And now you're talking about people who saw people fall as they shot them. And they don't walk away from that as normal people. Like Tom said, some people who did some of the worst things in Vietnam came back and were some of the greatest voices against the war. Something like that changes a person. No matter who you are, you're changing. You will always remember that. And what we need to do now is we have to harness all that energy and really use it for something good.
We've talked a lot today about how much people and forces and governments and media try to divide us, you know, say that we're separate, say that we're on one side of this thing, and Iraqi people and all Arabs and all the people who are liberated by the U.S. are on the other side. Say that we in the anti-war movement are on one side of things, but all the soldiers are on the other side. And I think that a big theme for me is that we're not separate at all. You know, we're united. You know, we have things in common with Iraqi people. We understand that in terms of soldiers, you know, they're not people way over there. You know, it's Kathleen's cousin. It's my cousin. It's my aunt, my uncle. It's our brother, Mike. You know, we're not separate. We talked a lot today about what empire does to human beings. You know, what it does to people. The disregard that the people who run this country, who run this system, have for the people who are the victims of the system. You know, the decisions that it forces them to make, how it takes their dreams, takes their children, things like that. But it's doing something else. That's the silver lining. It's uniting people. You know, there was the week before. Maybe it was a couple weeks before I went to Iraq, there was a delegation that went of military families. And so at least one person on that delegation was someone who lost his son in Iraq. And he was able to go speak with Iraqis and look face-to-face with Iraqis who lost their children too. And they were united because they understood that they're the same people. You know, we're the same people. And so that the unity, you know, we're uniting for the sake of ending this thing, you know. And just to flesh out for the people who didn't go to the talk on Vietnam, the stories that people were alluding to is that what happened was that U.S. troops who were against the war in Vietnam would wear symbols on, you know, whether it was that they painted a peace sign on their helmet or wore certain bandanas so that the Vietnamese would understand who they were and that they were against the war. And that then they refused to fire on them. You know, there was communication from the chain of command of the Vietnamese, the National Liberation Front, saying, don't fire on these guys. They're on our side. And that's where peace comes from. It's not going to come from George Bush. It's not going to come from a U.S. occupation. I don't think it's going to come from a U.N. occupation or an international occupation. It's going to come from people. Peace comes from below. And that's the example that we can look to. I want to close by reading a letter who actually I think better than I could ever say. Says what this war is about and why what the resistance in Iraq is about and why the U.S. needs to leave. And this is written by a woman named Laura, whose son is active duty, whose husband is active duty serving in Iraq. And she lives in Killeen, Texas. And this is a letter that was on the Bring the Troops Home Now webpage, and people should go to that webpage and read the letters of these military families. And I just want to read the end of it. The people in Iraq do not want us there. And most of us don't want to be there. They have been doing their thing for years, and who are we to come in busting in on their country? We wonder why so many soldiers are being killed. How would we react if soldiers from other countries came in and lined our streets with guns and tanks? We would do the same thing they're doing. How would we react if someone came in and told us how to run our government? These good men and women are losing their lives for nothing. Bring our troops home. That's what we're about. You know, we're about bringing the troops home. In our action on March 20, in our discussions today, it's all connected. You know, it's all connected to a bigger purpose. And then, you know, history tells us, history's on our side. You have these people in Texas drawing these conclusions. People whose families are over there, you know, they're drawing these conclusions. The facts are on our side. History shows that we're going to win.
Okay, that was excellent. So we're over time. There are a few announcements. Where the party is, West End, 113th and Broadway. And then there's going to be a meeting to coordinate proposals, merit proposals, for tomorrow.